I want to pay a special tribute to all of the creative and wonderful musicians who have supported the poets here at Duff's this year and every year. John Normant is among them, of course. There were references to the late Maurice Malik King, who I'll pay tribute to, as well as some other musicians who've played here and passed. David Hines, Julius Hemphill, and those who are still with us, many, many great musicians, J.D. Perrin, Papa Wright, who was here recently, Oliver Lake, Floyd LaFleur. The list goes on and on. There's something about freedom, music, and poetry that's very compatible. And some of our greatest poets have recognized that poets and musicians, poets and other artists should be listening to one another, should be mutually inspiring one another. And we're just happy that that's happening and has been happening for all these years in St. Louis. I think that gives the poetry its unique flavor and its individuality. We don't have any St. Louis style per se. We have a lot of different voices, and I think that's good. It's good. Well, where are you at? Do you need a break or you want to just plow ahead? No break. Okay, we ride the wave while it's hot. Okay, we're going to switch direction now, and we're going to bring up Richard Newman. Richard comes to us from southern Indiana. You may have read some of his music columns in the Riverfront Times, for whom he writes, and he also plays with a band called Junkbox. He is the current managing editor of River Styx, and without Richard, we would have not gotten our most recent issues out. He's done a really brilliant job of coordinating a lot of loose ends and doing some intelligent editing. Recently, he was a third-place winner in the Wednesday Club Poetry Contest. He's published in Delmar, Southern Indiana Review, and elsewhere. So please give a warm welcome to Richard Newman.
These poems are a tad quieter. Thanks. These first couple are from a series I have. It's called The Lucky Ones Got Away. They're basically stories out of where my family's from in southern Illinois. You'll kind of catch the flavor as we go on. The first one is pork flavored. It's called Elliot's Pig. Elliot's Pig was a demon pig. We found this out one night when it crossed the barbed wires, plunged down and up the creek bank, trampled the briars, the scraggly creek willows, to clatter the back porch cat dishes and wipe his nose on Ralph Edson's sliding glass door. And we all laughed at how that pig must have scared poor Ralph off his couch in a rumpus of clothes, one-ads, and month-old cereal bowls, and sent him into the night, swaying on his back porch in the blue light of his TV set for some time before he decided not to shoot. The next morning, we found Elliot's pig, plopped in the shade of Ralph Edson's broken-down riding mower that he ran hard into a tree once and left there to rust ever since. And it was all the four of us could do, Ralph, Elliot, Bernie Webster with his oversized snow shovel and myself, to get that pig in Elliot's truck. Its people eyes looked up at us, angry and bored, as we chased it on Ralph's weedy lawn and through the overgrown hedges. And finally, we got him halfway up the plank, and he just stopped there, not even looking at us, until Bernie Webster swatted his ass, and he stepped in the truck bed and lay down. And when that demon pig showed up again, a few days later in Ralph's backyard, Ralph didn't seem to mind. Probably threw him scraps of TV dinners or hamburger helper. Let him forage the wild onions and black walnuts and muddy the earth so Ralph wouldn't need to mow for a long time, if ever. And Elliot sure took his time getting that pig before he guessed this is how it's going to be, and drove it 15 miles into Toulon for slaughter. And now, the middle of fall, we drive past the Edson place with no grass, skeletons of shrubbery, and this year's black walnuts devoured holes and all. And that riding mower, like a rusted sundial, its shadow stretching longer and longer over Ralph Edson's trampled waste of a backyard. All right, thanks. That's the end. This next one is chicken flavored. It's called Taste Like Chicken. Quail, pheasant, goose you might expect, but frog legs, rabbit, squirrel, rattlesnake, these things too, I promise, taste like chicken. And if you like the taste of chicken, try the llama or the alligator soup, Terrapin Creek turtle or roasted dove. Don't be intimidated by a strange game or kangaroo or wild stir-fried dog. More often than not, most things taste like chicken. But one thing you might think tastes like chicken, at least a very big chicken, is ostrich, which actually doesn't taste like chicken at all, but tastes like steak or maybe a filet mignon. Your small game birds, snipe and plover, larks, thrush, and woodcocks, taste like chicken. Partridge, taste like chicken. Muskrat, taste like chicken. And a lot of things you wouldn't even guess. The sweetness of success or bitter failure. A savory victory or a bloody vengeance. That special yearn for lost childhood, family roots, and what you'd call the zest of life. All compare closely to the taste of chicken. And yes, I know what you're about to say. That even though it's all chicken, the secret lies in the infinite ways we can prepare it. Let me remind you that any way you cut through countless recipes and endless sauce, it all boils down to the basic chicken, clucking over this entire chicken shit world. More common than trees and good black dirt. After all, we made the chicken, bred it, adjusted it to the human taste bud, the bare standard we now hold in nature. So you better learn to like the taste of chicken. And more important than that, its aftertaste, which you may belch up again and again from that unsettling soup deep in your belly. Thanks. All right, a couple more from this series. This one is bug-flavored. It's called The Girl from Saline County. This is a true story. Well, they're all true, of course, but this one is really true. The girl from Saline County, barely too old to cry, lay awake until sunrise, picking ants from her eyes. Behind the door of her bedroom in the watery light of the moon, dozens and dozens would climb from a tear duct one at a time. And then her parents discovered her secret beneath the covers, and they couldn't say how many years of hush-hushed fights their daughter kept creeping company after they shut the door and tucked her in for the night. This mysterious open sore betrayed what strangeness inside. The city doctors supplied reassuring elusive smiles and various insect sprays, which only worked for a while. Later, they tried to obstruct her over-trafficked tear duct, but ants continued to stray, less, but still several each day. And her listless photo appeared in the weekly News of the Weird, an American medical journal. She became completely nocturnal, avoiding the media lights and staying up all night, lovingly picking her ants and rolling them into crumbs between her finger and thumb. The community and her parents, for too many months the stuff of tabloids, and all profoundly ashamed, said finally enough and ordered the tear gland lanced or removed, and her deliverance from this steady trail of ants leading from Saline County. But she carried into adulthood, as any afflicted would, an inexplicable twitch triggered by a moonlit sky, a dull and vague kind of itch in the corner of a parched red eye. Thanks. All right, this is a true story. It's called For the Taking. Down in the mud valley, out in the back flats, an engine in full throttle tears through the thick green corn stalks, its high-pitched whine slapping an echo against the bluffs. Someone is whirring up the dust, yellow smoke burning off the dirt road. Someone is making a getaway. Someone has found Jesus in a rusty, dust-covered hatchback, making off with a trunkload of field corn. The station wagon had pulled up with out-of-state plates, two kids in back, squinting through windows rolled up tight. Mom, in large round glasses, leaned her head outside. "May I help you?" she asked. "The owner said I could fill up my trunk with corn," he said, stacking the unripe ears through the open hatchback. The man's windblown wife and skinny kids sat on dusty, torn-up seats, staring blankly through the streaked windows that only rolled halfway down. "I'm the owner," Mom laughed, politely yet forcefully, "and nobody asked me." "Well, I talked to somebody who farms this land, and he said I could fill my trunk." "Well, I think it would be best if you take what you have and then move along." The dust from the hatchback settles, and the station wagon sits cockeyed in the dirt road, the front end sloping down in one worn groove like a small white schooner tossed in a green sea of swirling unripe corn stalks. "Why did they want this corn, Mom? Don't they know this corn is grown for pigs?" "I guess some people don't know any better," she says. "Some people think all corn is the same." Thanks. Okay, so these other ones are from a series, another series. It's called Love, Marriage, and the Rest of the World. You guys want, like, kind of like down in the dumps, annoyed one, or you want like a happy, optimistic, exuberant one? Okay, everybody who wants down in the dumps on this end, and okay, well, here's one I don't read very often, but I wrote this one after hearing a buddy of mine, Kay Curtis Lyle, do a reading here, and I was kind of inspired for some reason. It's called Top Down. I'll let you figure out which side of the room it falls on. Because we put the top down and our heads up, we felt the wind's long, indifferent fingers through our hair, the rush of cool night air, and drove down the belly of America. Because we put the top down and our heads up and rumbled down the empty night highways and dusty back roads looking for a place to fuck, we helped ourselves to any size slice of moon the summer sky offered us, while a few cows gaped like unabashed children from their side of the wire fence. And we saw the tops of bulging green trees and the swaying telephone lines connecting each city of lights, the cloud-streaked sky, noticed every single thing we ran over and everything growing smaller behind us because we put the top down and our heads up. Because we put the tops down and our heads up, our eyes dried out. and our skin tingled long after we stopped and lay under the cool, still sheets at the Cherokee Motel after 12 road hours, switching driver's seats, at last motionless in each other's arms, lying thoughtful but without any thoughts, feeling from the top down each other's warm engine hum and satisfied exhaustion. Not as if we'd escaped what we'd left behind, but that we'd again discovered something new, something we'd carried with us all this time, something dark and rushing, gentle and rough, because we chose to drive with the top down and our heads up. How am I doing on time? All right, we're going to wrap it up here. Here are three little ditties for you. This one's called True Feelings. What are my feelings for? Sliding under the bedroom door and getting trampled by your feet. Dragging up and down the street at night along the slats of a fence, or covering myself against your chill like a loose-knit sweater. Some uses are better. Tickling each other's feet and heads upstairs in our bed, hanging on the line outside and dangling ostentatious pride, are like a pair of woolen briefs, constricting, itching, with no relief, or even letting them creep like roots or squirm like cold eels through the darkness, finding the truth that nothing, and I want to stress this, nothing we can feel could ever be very important. Here's another little ditty. It's called Night Walk. So sick of this board gnawing at my heart and my knack of finding despair and misery pooling like backwater in a neighbor's yard, or noticing under even the healthiest tree the little white lumps of poison fungus picking up the light of someone's TV, I want to come home and find things to bless. I want to bless our slow, groggy mornings of strong coffee, bagels, and blood oranges. Bless the kitchen window flowers in bloom. Bless the grackles, afternoon harangues, the creaky stairs leading up to our bedroom. Your back in the moonlight, my you-seeking jism. And yes, let me not forget so soon. Bless my qualms, if not my cynicism. All right, this is the last one. A lot of these have been published in various places or have won little contests. This one has not. No one wants it. It hasn't been published anywhere. But I like it, so, you know, this is my chance to read it. This was written before the birth of the child I had. My wife and I had this child. This is called Dream Children. In your dream, our child was born Chinese, with straight gun-blue hair and piercing eyes. It got stuck in the bathtub, fastened down by forceful dream logic, and you couldn't pry it loose as our love child let fly a stream of incomprehensible language, not baby gibberish, but words that must have been Chinese. And in my dream, we lay asleep in bed, and you gave birth to our child, which rolled off the foot of the bed, planted itself in the hardwood floor, and grew into a tree. These dream children we keep having, certainly no stranger than those from what we call the real world, grow out of our possibilities. Our dream child grows, blooms. Its roots get pulled into the basement through the black loam and the hot heart of the world, with one stray tendril poking through the soil in China. We, dream children, fight that tug. Try always to snap out of this incomprehensible waking dream, this dream that pulls us blindly through the world. Thanks.